Junji.
Hi, my name is June. I'm an alcoholic again. Well, as I was listening to Jimmy and Joe, I found out that there were topics. And so, I probably won't be living up to my topic, which I just found out what it was. That's not that unusual for me, because I have a tendency to kind of go to the last page rather than read all the beginning stuff. This seems really loud to me. Am I doing okay? Okay. kind of made me think, you know, when I was new, somewhere in my first year of sobriety at my Monday night Venice home group, a woman talked, I don't remember who it was, and when she spoke, she said, "Can I see the hands?" I'm not asking this. She asked this. "Can I see the hands of all the people here tonight who have read the entire big book of Alcoholics Anonymous from the beginning to the end?" And my home group had probably 100 people, I'd say, that night. And I had not read every page in the big book. There were several chapters that really didn't apply. The employers, I didn't have a job. Wives, you know, I mean, it was like, you know, I was just skipping all around. But I looked around, and I'd say about half of the people in my home group raised their hand, and I'm sorry to tell you this, but I'm pretty sure a few of them were lying. But I'm kind of competitive, and I thought, I don't know how often this person speaks, and I want to be able to raise my hand the next time she asks. And so I read the entire big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's 51 years later now, and no one has ever asked that question again. But I found a lot of good stuff in some of the parts that I was skipping. So we'll see how this goes. You know, I am a story person. That's just kind of what's helped me so much in my sobriety. And when I was listening to Jimmy and Joe and, you know, stuff there, and then having lunch, it made me think about my buddy John Vicar. John V, if you ever get a chance to listen to his talk, it's really, really a remarkable story. I'm not going to tell you all of John's story, but I'll give you just a couple of highlights. So John was a Mi'kmaq Indian, grew up on a reservation. When he was a young boy, I think there were 9 children, I think 7 of them, and both his parents died from tuberculosis, and so the reservation asked him and his sister to leave because they didn't understand how it was being transferred, and they thought they were carriers. And so he left the reservation at that point. He went on, and you know, he had a life. You can listen to a little bit of his talk, but basically he started drinking, and he did virtually all of his drinking on Skid Row. He never learned to read or write. He just went straight to Skid Row, and he did his drinking there. And while he was drinking on Skid Row, he ended up at one point, well, many times, you know, I think he was in Syracuse, New York at that time, on Skid Row, where it's rather cold. So he would go to missions so that he could stay inside. And the missions would have a rule that you had to go to a meeting of some kind that the mission had, you know, or you couldn't have a bed. And so, you know, when he would get cold enough and things were tough, he would go and he would listen to their mission meeting, whatever it was. And so one night he was at one of those meetings for the mission. So he'd completed his requirement. So he was getting a bed. And a guy walked up to him. And we'll just call him Bob because there's always a Bob. And Bob walked up to him. Bob was someone that he drank with on Skid Row. And Bob said, "Joe," he goes, "I'm sober." And you know, that's not always the most exciting news to others. Thank you, Sam. And so, you know, John said, you know, okay. And Bob said, "Would you like to go to a meeting with me?" And John said, "No." He said, "I've already been to a meeting. I got my bed. I don't want to go to a meeting." And Bob said, "Well, they have donuts." So John said, "I'll go." And he went to his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He never drank again. The speaker that night was a judge. And he would say, you know, it's not that he'd never seen a judge before. He had many times. But it wasn't like he was going to relate. And yet, because he understood the feelings. And he came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. This guy, Bob, started to pick him up every night at the mission to take him to a meeting, and did that for several days. And when he would pick him up, he would come to pick John up, and he would bring a sack lunch. And he'd say, "John, I need you to help me out. I need you to do me a favor." He said, "My wife makes me a sandwich every night, and it really hurts her feelings if I don't finish my sandwich. And I can only eat half, and I'm wondering if you could help me out and eat half of this sandwich." So John would help him out and eat half of the sandwich. And John said he was a number of years sober before he realized this guy was actually having dinner with his family every night before he came to pick him up. And that's why he could only eat half a sandwich. He'd already eaten. But he knew that if he gave John the entire sandwich, that John would have been too proud and would not have accepted it. And I think about how important it is, you know, here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that part of one alcoholic talking to another, of how we don't share from up on high. We actually frequently share from our lowest point when we're working with someone new and when we're, you know, we're trying to help and be of service. So I'm supposed to share a little bit on steps 8 and 9, which you already know. I told you I don't necessarily stay on topic, which I've just proven. But, you know, I thought too of this, you know, guy that had, shared at the Sunday Noon Ohio Street one day, and he was talking about how, you know, when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're kind of looking at these first steps, and you're really beginning, you know, especially, you know, the 4 and 5 and the 8 and 9, and you're looking at the mess, you know, the wreckage of our past. He said it's kind of like you have a mountain of sand in front of your front door. I mean, you can't even see over it. It's like, how is this, what is ever going to help, you know, me get over with this mountain that's there? And he said, it's as if your sponsor kind of says things to you like, here's what I want you to do. Every morning, I want you to take this teaspoon, and I want you to take a teaspoon of the sand from the mountain, from the front of your door, and take it out to the back of where you live. It's like, a teaspoon? I mean, I need a crane, you know. No, we're going to give you a teaspoon, you know. And most of us who've stayed sober that I have shared, you know, with me, we've all been frustrated at times about how slow that teaspoon process, you know, works. And yet it does. I think that, you know, it talks about in, when I was reading in step 8 last night in the 12 and 12, it talks about, you know, our defective relationships have always been the immediate cause of most of our woes. And I don't think any of us are doing all that well in that area when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so the process that Jimmy and Joe talked about making that realistic appraisal, and then we have this list, or we begin to make this list. I want to say one more time, which I know I said before, that I can't think of a time when a sponsor is more important. They're important so many times. But before we begin to run out and do those ninth step amends, and the way that we want to say what we want to say, you know, it's really important for us to have somebody, a sponsor or an advisor, whatever it's going to be, that's going to look at your best idea for how this is going to, you know, go forward. And, you know, In long-term sobriety, it has been very important for me to run things by my sponsor or somebody. And I can remember, you know, I went through a divorce, and I had my ex would send me page-long emails. And then I would try to respond line by line, and my sponsor said, "I want to see what you're writing back." And so I would send it to my sponsor, and my sponsor would say, "Some of that is wonderful writing. I think actually some of, you know, you could probably publish some of the sarcastic remarks, you know, that you've thrown in there." And he said, "And here's what I want you to do." I go, "Yeah." He said, "I want you to delete all of it and say no." So, you know, it's important as we go forward, no matter how long we're sober, And that makes me think of, you know, I remember reading something, and it was an article about several different wisdom teachers, you know, in the world, and they were kind of having a meeting of wisdom teachers, and they were sharing different ideas. But, you know, one of them said, and the other two in, that I'm thinking of, you know, the Dalai Lama, and I think it was Desmond Tutu, and I can't remember for the moment who else the other one was, but they all said they never made a major decision in their life without listening to at least three people. They didn't always do what any one or all three of the other people said. But I think the importance of that humility of knowing and being reminded, you know, again, that I don't always know, and I have I can be a master at justification without knowing that I'm doing that. So, you know, for me, in part, some of the amends process and the knowing that I needed to make amends, these were things that I had to have explained to me. For example, you know, I mean, I have a lot of similarity to some of the things that, you know, that Jimmy talked about the way that I grew up. So my sponsor had a much broader definition of a lie than I did. I thought if you didn't ask and I didn't say anything, that's not a lie. And then I would sometimes do things like I could say, my car wouldn't start, so I'm going to be late. My sponsor felt that that was a lie because they didn't say to me, did you turn the key and try to start your car? And I go, no, they didn't ask that. Therefore, I had not lied. They didn't ask these, and I had a lot of that that I just sort of thought was not really lying. And so she was, you know, very, very strict about the lying, you know, thing. One time, I'll tell you this story real quick. Oh, my God, the timer thing again. Jeez, okay. We'll have been here long enough by the end of the day, and you'll be grateful I remembered the timer part. Okay, so I believe it was right before I got sober, but I can't really remember. It could have even been when I was a week or two sober. I was always a thief. I was a thief before I started to drink. I was a thief while I drank. I stole my first big book in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I felt that drinking and stealing were totally unrelated. And, you know, I grew up really poor. If you had something and I wanted it, I'd better steal it, because I was never going to get it any other way. And that's really what I believed for a long, long time. So somewhere, you know, within a month of getting sober, I stole a ring. I had never had a ring, and I stole this ring. And it was, you know, not a very big ring or, you know, whatever, but it was a ring. And after I was sober in my early days of sobriety, somebody saw my ring in a meeting, and they said, is that an amethyst? So I don't know. You know, I stole a ring. I mean, I don't know. It's a purple stone. They go, that's an amethyst. And I go, oh. And they said, you know, in ancient times, the Greeks and the Romans would swallow whole amethysts because they believed that it prevented drunkenness. And so now I know that this ring is part of why I'm staying sober. It's preventing drunkenness, and I was clearly meant to have this ring. And I don't think about it at all as being a stolen ring. It's my lucky sober ring. And I don't know, I'm maybe 2 years sober, 4 years sober. I don't know, I'm sober for a while. And I'm at a Denny's, probably, with, you know, like 20 people. And I'm at this end of the table, and I'm telling them my funny ring story about my lucky amethyst ring that's keeping me sober. And unbeknownst to me, my sponsor, this was one of my first sponsors, at the other end of the table is listening to my ring story. But I don't really know that, because I'm down here laughing with my friends about my lucky amethyst ring. And Bob, different Bob than my sponsor today, who's Bob Regan with 57 years, different Bob, he says, can I see that ring? And I said, sure. And I go over to show him my lucky ring. And he said, that's a very nice ring. And I said, yes, you know, sober, lucky. And he says, I'm glad you've enjoyed that ring. He goes, because this is the last day you're going to wear it. I go, what? He goes, yeah, you're going to donate that ring to the women's recovery home tomorrow, as soon as you get back. And I said, but I've never had a ring. He said, I understand, and that's not your ring. And I said, well, if I was able to, and remember, I wasn't able to put a dollar in the basket, so it was pretty unlikely. I go, but if I was able to, like, come up with a way to make enough money to get some money, can I buy it at the garage sale or at the... And he goes, no, because it's not your ring. And I felt that was very strict, kind of overdoing the whole, you know, AA thing. But it was like I really had no idea that there was something wrong with that. I remember I worked in an office in my early sobriety, and they had this one room in the office where it was like the Xerox machine and, you know, whatever other kinds of machines that they have in office-y places. They had this one machine, and if you put a letter in there, it stamped it. It was like a magic stamp machine. And so I would take my bills to work. There was another woman who worked there who I got sober with, and she told me I should bring Christmas cards. And I didn't, this company, it just had a stamp machine. I never really thought about where that money, you know what I mean? It's like, so this has been a slow process for me. And, you know, I've come to see, and, you know, interestingly enough, my buddy John that I just talked about, the Mi'kmaq Indian who, you know, went straight to Skid Row, I remember saying something to him about stealing, because I was, you know, hopefully I wasn't stealing as much by the time I met John, if at all, hopefully. But I didn't even feel that bad about stealing in the early years. It's just kind of what you have to do. You know, I mean, it's just, you got to breathe and steal. I mean, and John said something to me, and I'm sure I won't be able to put it exactly into words, and yet it was like it touched my heart, and I've never quite forgotten it. And he said, you know, I never stole. I go, you didn't steal? I mean, for crying out loud, you're homeless on Skid Row. He said, yeah. He said, I always knew that when we steal, we take something away from our own selves. We take away more than we could ever get. And I just had never even heard of that as a concept, you know. So, you know, there are things in my life in sobriety that the old timers, you know, needed to share with me about, you know, lying and stealing and you know, having morals. I couldn't have told you what anything about that was, and I really thought they were stupid, dangerous to have morals, because you're going to be taken advantage of badly living out there trying to do things this way. So it took me a long time in AA to believe that this design for living could really work in that world, in the real world. So I hurt a lot of people in my life, and a lot of the people that I hurt were young. They were kids. I was a kid. I got sober at 13. I was the oldest 13-year-old you will ever meet. I felt at least 1,000 years old for years after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did not believe there was anything in the book, the literature, the steps, any of this that was ever going to help how much I hated myself and how old I felt. And many of the people that I hurt, I don't know their name. I certainly don't know their last name, if I could even remember their first name. And, you know, I think a lot about that, you know, saying that we sometimes hear more, you know, in this day and age, but about, you know, hurt people. And I was hurt a lot as a kid in a lot of different ways. There was a lot of different kinds of abuse, and I inflicted those kind of abuse as well. And so I'm not really able to make a direct amends to these people. And so in my life, in sobriety, one of the things that I did was I got very, very active. I have children today. I have 3 daughters, but I got very, very active in soccer. Which was something, sports have always been pretty important to me. I got very active with my daughters in sports, and I became, you know, the commissioner, and I did a lot of service in my local community, trying to give back to some kids in a hope that maybe soccer would help them through their tough spots. And that was one of the ways that I tried to make amends, you know, for that. I also, I volunteered, you know, again, because I had kids, I knew about this, and I volunteered, you know, in the school so that I could try and, you know, do some things to help make the school better, to give back to these young kids who I'm sure some of them were experiencing some of the kinds of abuse and torment that I had, but I didn't know, and I might never find out from them. I was in a lot of foster homes in my life, and, you know, I came to find, and this is sort of, I'm kind of doubling, you know, the steps, I'm kind of going back and forth here, but I felt so sorry for myself for so many years after I was sober. It's been a very slow process for me to not be so self-centered, and so I don't know. I'm thinking I was definitely over 20 years sober or more before I really started to see some of the damage that I brought to these foster homes. These were families. I was fortunate. I know that there's some bad foster homes. I had great foster homes. I had foster homes that were 1,000 times safer than my home, my own family and home ever was. And, you know, I remember my first foster home, I was 6 years old. I got there. He was an engineer. She was a stay-at-home mom. And they had a beautiful home. And they had one daughter. And they just wanted to help a kid, you know. And I would go into the kitchen, and I would grab a butcher knife. And I would run down their cul-de-sac where everybody knew everybody and all the kids played. And I would, you know, threaten to kill myself, and they'd have to tackle me. You know, I had other foster homes, and I'd run and scream out the window. And by this time, I'm drinking, and I'm using, and I'm destroying the neighborhood. And, you know, it never occurred to me until many years sober to say thank you to those people. I was so badly abused over and over, which was true, but I never took time to look at some of the kindnesses and to say thank you. And so that kind of an idea of thank you amends has become, you know, something that I try to share with some of the people after they've worked through the process of our original, you know, amends of where we're, you know, looking for the harm and seeing what we can do and the ways. You know, I did a lot of stealing, as I mentioned. My sponsor decided that the best way for me to return, because I had no idea how much I had stolen, I stole a lot of food, I stole a lot of other things. Again, I didn't know who they were or where they were or whatever. And so, you know, I made donations to, you know, at that time, the Midnight Mission. It was a mission that I knew. And, you know, that's where I took the money that I could bring. And I stole money. I stole library books, including the big book from the library. And I went to the librarian and I explained I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I returned those books. And I had also stolen a copy of the 12 and 12 because that was important too. And you know, the librarian, she said, you know, I used to work in this library in Laguna Beach. And she said, this person came in and said the same thing you just said. She goes, I guess you guys do this kind of thing all the time. So, but you know, it was like, in a sense, the fact that I thought the big book was valuable enough to steal was progress for me. I mean, I thought it was important, you know. But, you know, that didn't mean that I didn't need to return it and make amends or pay for a new one, you know. You know, Mark frequently, he goes to this, you know, there's like a used store in our neighborhood, and he'll look around and, you know, he'll find a big book. And when he does, we have a little library thing at the end of our street. And he'll throw one in there, and we walk by it every day on our way, you know, take our dog for a walk, and we look and see if it's still there. And, you know, one time we saw a guy riding on a bicycle, bringing it back. But hey, you never know. So let's see here. The importance of remembering that when we're making our amends, that we can't buy peace at the cost of anyone else. And also that it's about taking care of our side of the street. And that is, again, where a sponsor can be so invaluable, because it's really hard, because sometimes when we need to make amends, there have been some things that have been done to us, and we'd sort of like to list those first and get it, you know, clear, but that's not, you know, part of that process. And we, you know, it's hard not to do that sometimes, so it's important to, you know, to run that by somebody else. And so the majority of my amends, however, have been living amends. I was raised by an alcoholic mother who also suffered from poverty and mental illness and a tremendous amount of violence. And, you know, over the years, I've come to think that perhaps, you know, there were brain injuries as well as her, you know, mental illness, or, I don't know, chicken, egg, you know, whatever it was. I was not an easy daughter. I was a very angry daughter. I was a very violent daughter, and I felt that I had been wronged and that a lot of bad things had happened as a result of my mother, and to some extent, a lot of that is very, very true. And yet, when I was maybe 7 years sober, I realized that had it not been for the hell of my mother's alcoholism, as well as my own, I would not have found Alcoholics Anonymous when I did. And so my mother was the reason that I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. I was able to get sober. My mother did not stay sober. She was going to go in and out for another 30 years. I'm bad at numbers, but a long time. But my mom passed away last year. She died with, she was just a few weeks from 19 years of continuous sobriety. I was able to practice the principles that we learn here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was able to show up. I was able to show up when I didn't want to, and I was able to show up when I didn't feel like it, and I was able to, most of the time, you know, practice love and tolerance, and I needed a lot of support, you know, as I did that at different times. You know, sometimes Mark would come with me, and, you know, earlier years, my aunt was able to come with me because there was still violence going on, and so being in certain situations, it wasn't safe for me to be there alone. And but anyway, years later, I was following my mom in a car one day, and I'd been sober, I don't know, maybe 10 years or something. And she had a bumper sticker on the back of her car, and it said, "My daughter is a winner." And that wasn't the bumper sticker she would have chosen in 1972 when I got sober. You know, things had changed, and I had become, you know, an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was learning how to practice the principles that I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous: get to the meeting on time, go whether you want to or not, show up and do what you say you're going to do, stay for the whole meeting, you know, even if you don't like the speaker, even if you don't like, you know, some of the people in the room, believe it or not. You know, I heard a guy in Texas once, and he said, you know, if you like everybody in AA, you might not be going to enough meetings. So, you know, but, I mean, these are the kind of things, you know, that, like, Joan and I, you know, have shared about in our sobriety, about that idea of not leaving a meeting. I mean, if I left a meeting sometimes, you know, if I started to leave a meeting because I didn't like what someone said, I know that it could happen more and more, or I'd be leaving a meeting. You know, and so I don't. I try. I'm not perfect. I try not to talk to people during a meeting. I cannot tell you how many times I have heard somebody say something in a meeting, and it has made a huge difference to me in my life. And they weren't, you know, I don't remember who said it. And I don't even remember, you know, like one time I was having a very difficult time. I had three people in my life that I cared about very much who were all struggling from severe physical illnesses, undiagnosed. It was excruciating to watch. There was a lot of fear, you know, going on in these three people's lives. And I heard a guy at a meeting, and he shared about his little boy had ended up in Cedars Hospital. They didn't know why, and it was intensive care. And the child did lose a kidney, and he, you know, the dad was just like losing his mind. And he called his sponsor, and his sponsor said, "We don't go into the darkness to pull people out. We stay in the light so that they can come to us." You know, and Alcoholics Anonymous and the examples of so many people, as I've watched what they have walked through, have taught me that over and over. You know, the importance that we talk about in the book where it says, cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. You know, and it's really important. It's been very important for me, you know, the people that have been able to make me laugh and, you know, the different ways I'm sure it's because I'm down here and, you know, because this always happens to me when I'm down here. Plus, I know that, you know, Joan in particular was really close with Cliff Roach, who was, you know, just a really great guy and a really good friend of me. Took me for my first, you know, surfing lesson. I, you know, didn't give me a wetsuit though, so I kind of had to postpone. I got obsessed with that later, but it's added tremendously to my life over the years. And Cliff, you know, again, if you get a chance to hear his talk, just in case you never have, I know a lot of you probably have because you live here, but, you know, just amazing, his sense of humor. And I called him one time. I was 35 years sober. I was having a hard time. I was going through that divorce. I was worried about these three kids. And I started thinking. I think it was Jimmy that was talking about, you know, this busy thing, and then Joe too was talking about what's in between, you know, when we're here. But, you know, here I am, you know, I'm 35 years sober, and I start thinking, and I get a thing in my head, and I think, I don't have a five-year plan. I don't have a five-year plan. What is my five-year plan? Now, you know, and I'll get these things. And so I called up Cliff. I go, Cliff! And he's like, yeah. I go, I don't have a five-year plan. He goes, what? I go, I don't have a five-year plan, Cliff. I go, I'm having a really hard time. I'm 35 years. I don't have a five-year plan. He goes, doesn't your home group meet today in 2 hours? I go, well, yeah. He goes, well, why don't you go to the meeting and call me after? Go to the meeting. I mean, 35 years sober. I mean, don't we have a little upper level, you know, I mean, come on, a little something that we're going to, you know, that we're going to add to this. It's like, no, I went to the meeting, I felt better. You know, I still don't have a five-year plan, but I get these things. But, you know, and when I was going through that hard time, I was talking to my sponsor, Bob Regan. I was talking to Sandy Beach every week. Both of them had never met each other. And they both independently at different times said to me, stop thinking and have fun. Now, if you can imagine that these old timers are telling me that at 35, can you imagine what I was like when I was new? I mean, my first sponsor, I don't honestly think she could have answered my calls if she had call waiting back then. They didn't have it, and I'm very grateful they didn't, you know, because I was a mess. So let me see, what else did I want to, I wanted to share a couple other stories about. You know, here's a, you know, kind of a, one of those other kind of amends that came into my life. I was raised Catholic. My entire family always stayed very active in Catholicism. And I was very angry. I was very angry at God. I was very angry at the church. I was angry at everything, really. I was angry at me, you know, so it's not a big surprise that I was angry. But I felt as I got to this point where I'm telling you at 20, 25 years sober, when I started to like look at things in my life, I know today that I owe a huge amends to the Catholic Church. I know that I have, this is just me, doesn't matter, everybody else can do whatever they want. But for me, it was, I did damage when I made my Catholic jokes sometimes at meetings. Here is this group that I had decided some things about because of things that I thought I heard. And, you know, as we stay sober longer and longer, we sometimes find out that things weren't said that we heard, you know. And part of one of the things that happened, too, was I went to, I had a very dear friend in Alcoholics Anonymous who passed away, and he was a practicing Catholic. And when he passed away, you know, normally, I don't know what you guys do here, but, you know, in L.A., we usually have a celebration of life, like at a meeting hall, you know, thing. And I try to go to those if and when I can. And this particular date that they were having Vince's memorial, I was going to be speaking in another state or someplace, and I wasn't going to be able to go. And this was a guy, I got sober in 1972, you know, with him. I had longer than him, which you never let those people forget. So we were close. And I really, I loved his wife, Pat, so I wanted to pay my respects and be there, and I couldn't go to the memorial, and there was going to be a mass. It's like, I don't really do mass, you know, but I needed to do something. I went to this mass, and the priest that led the mass that day, he happened to be from Ireland, and one of the things that he said at the time of communion was, he said, I'd like to ask anyone to come up, not necessarily to receive communion if you're not a Catholic and you don't practice that sacrament, but because we'd like to offer you, you know, our hand and a sign of peace. And I thought, the Catholic Church has changed. I mean, it has, truly, but I never gave it a chance. You know, being, I held it to what I remembered that wasn't even accurate, you know, from when I was a kid and my grandmother died and I gave up on, you know, God and the church. And so, and that was part of where I started to see that it was really important to me to try to be respectful of other people's religious beliefs. I can be sarcastic, or I consider it funny, but... You know, I remember Cliff Roach saying at one point, you know, he said, you know, sarcasm translates to a tearing of the flesh. And so I started to pull back a little bit on my wit. Because I don't, you know, that's not what I want to, it's not what I want to do. And I hope you guys, I'm sure you guys know that these are like practice, you know, not like something I never did again or, you know, anything remotely like that. So I'm going to tell you this other story that I heard from somebody. I think it was Sandy, but I'm not 100% sure. So apparently there was a young guy, and he used to break into people's houses. And the houses that he broke into, he happened to, he liked to work cul-de-sacs. And so he'd broken into, you know, like 8 houses on the same little cul-de-sac. And he kind of slowly over the years in his sobriety, he was going to each house to find out, you know, what he remembered taking to make amends, then to pay them back, you know, and then he would go, you know, to another house. And maybe it wasn't every single house, but, you know, in these different little cul-de-sac areas. And so his amends had gone fairly well. He was able to slowly pay these people back, doing kind of one at a time. And he came to this one, he had to go to this one house. And like I said, things had been going pretty well. They're like, you know, yeah, we'll take the money. Thanks for telling us about our TV. And, you know, so he went to this next house and he knocked on the door and a woman answered the door and she didn't know who he was. And he said, you know, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I stole from you and I'm here to see if I can, you know, make amends and to explain a little bit about why I need to do this. She goes, just a minute, just a minute. And she closed the door. And then she came back, and she brought her husband. She said, tell him what you just said. Tell him what you just said. And so he told the man the same thing, and they invited him in, and he ended up talking. And it, she started to cry, and she said, you know, we've never let our son in our home the last 7 years because we believed that he was the person who had stolen, you know, from us. And so just this idea that sometimes our process of making amends, it's much bigger than we even realize how we can help, you know, the world and other people heal. There was another story a guy had told that I just thought this was just so cool. So there was this guy, he stole film in New York, and I don't know New York at all, but there's a Hasidic Jewish neighborhood in New York. And it was in the days when they would have, you know, like those yellow boxes, I guess, of Kodak, and it would be like on the counter. And so he was just kind of a young kid, and he would run in, and he'd grab like 4 boxes of that film, and then he'd go out and he'd sell it or, you know, do whatever. And so now he was sober, and he wanted to make amends. And so he went into this store, which was still in the Hasidic neighborhood, and a guy, you know, came to the counter and said, you know, can I help you? And he said, you know, 10 years ago when I was drinking. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I need to, you know, want to try and repay. And I stole, you know, at least 30 boxes, you know, of film. And, you know, I think they're $4 a box. You know, I can't, I'm just making stuff up here. But, you know, there's this amount. And so, you know, I want to pay you the $120 and see if there's anything else that I could do to set things right. And the guy said, well, just a minute. And he goes, I got to go in the back. So the Hasidic, you know, clerk, you know, went in the back. And he was there for a little while. And the guy's starting to get nervous. You know, he's maybe calling the police or, you know, whatever. And they're talking. And he can hear, and they're kind of, you know, talking loud, you know, and he hears a lot of voices, you know, and he was like, what is going on back there? And then the guy came out, and he said, well, he said it would violate our ethics to accept $4 a box, because at the time that you stole it, we were adding up, it was, you know, $237 a box. And and so, you know, this idea that, you know, as we're making amends and we find out that there are other people who sometimes live by these principles and they didn't need a sponsor, they didn't need that. So I have this one page I want to read, if I can find it, which I know I will, but it takes me a minute. Okay, I think it's right here. No, that's not it. Doggone it. All right, give me just a second. I know you're all looking at me. All right. Let's see. Mm-hmm. Oh, it can't be that hard. Otherwise, I'm going to have to paraphrase, and it's just not as good. There it is. I found it. Okay. You know, if I could remember page numbers as well as I remember some of these AA stories, it would be, I'd be invaluable. So this is talking about, this is from The Family Afterward, one of the chapters that I skipped because I wasn't having a family afterward for a long time. So, okay. They may not see why their love and devotion did not straighten him out. Dad is not so spiritual after all, they say. If he means to right his past wrongs, why all this concern for everyone in the world but his family? What about his talk that God will take care of them? They suspect Father is a bit balmy. He is not so unbalanced as they might think. Many of us have experienced Dad's elation. We have indulged in spiritual intoxication. Like a gaunt prospector, belt drawn in over the last ounce of food, our pick struck gold. Joy at our release from a lifetime of frustration knew no bounds. Father feels he has struck something better than gold. For a time, he may try to hug the new treasure to himself. He may not see at once that he has barely scratched a limitless lode, which will pay dividends only if he mines it for the rest of his life and insists on giving away the entire product. And I will tell you, 51 years sober, when I read that, I go, the entire product? I mean, you know, don't we want to keep like a prudent reserve? You know. Thank you for letting me be a part of your day.